Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And yes, tonight we have another very interesting show dealing with the general area of esoteric psychology, which we had a show on last week. Tonight we're going to focus in on the development of self, or self-development, and it will be from eventually from the understanding of God's perspective of us, God or our Creator. So, looking at it from a new perspective in some respects than I usually teach it, and also trying to create or build up an understanding from the most basic elements of life and even pre-life, leading to how a self actually creates itself. Because that's the magic of the self, is that it is not a thing or an entity that exists by being made by something else, but rather it is created by itself, which is a little hard for people to understand. Which is exactly, by the way, that most people have a difficulty understanding how or where or what God is, because one of the first questions many people have is, if God exists, then who created God? Well, if God can be self-created and something else that we're familiar with, but we don't necessarily understand, called the self, is self-created, then there's a connection. And through understanding one, we can eventually understand the other. So tonight's show may lead us in that direction. If it doesn't do that, then, of course, it's either from this side of the fence, or possibly as you are listening, it's going to be something that isn't quite connecting in your own understanding. So we'll do the best. I'll do the best I can to present what I think is the approach that most people would find the easiest way to gain this level of understanding. Now, when I say understanding, that leads us to a whole other framework, which has to do with consciousness. And before I define consciousness, I would like to start by defining the rudiments of what begins in consciousness before there actually is. And the first is sense. If there is no information coming in to what we're going to loosely describe as a mind, because right now we don't know what that mind is by the definition yet, if there's no information, mind is mindless because it doesn't have the tools to construct itself. Okay. Oh, it's starting to sound like something about itself. Yeah, that's right. And the process is very subtle. It is not something that is obvious, because if it were, tonight's show would not be probably needed. Everybody would say, well, I know what it is. I know what a self is. I know what this is. I know what that is. But it's subtle. And why is it so subtle? Well, because the development of information even is extremely tedious and slow in as life becomes more complex. And the complexity is due to the thing we call senses. In each sense, there are a total of 7 possible senses in 3 different bodies that we're familiar with. And I say bodies, I'm talking about, just like we think of as our body, a physical body, but there's also an extra 2-dimensional bodies besides the physical that are connected to us, although the mind itself, the seat of our focus in consciousness, is directed towards the physical body. That's where we are presently aligned. But the other 2 bodies exist, even though the focus of our life and attention is not at the present time in them. And we get information through these senses and bodies in these other dimensional parts of ourselves. They're called, in esoteric terms, they're called the astral and monastic or mental body. But the point is that when we get information, and the more we have of it, the greater the ability for a mind to do thinking, and the more interactions that mind can choose to have with its environment. Does this make sense? Kind of does, doesn't it? And then is eventually the mind goes further, we'll call it. And there is a opportunity, we'll say, in the growth of information to bring information into a meaningful or a greater level of understanding, which I'm going to start calling consciousness. Understanding of consciousness, the ability to bring together this information and to connect it in new ways. But eventually, in the beginning, it just brings more information in, which makes more complex information, and the complexity of the information eventually becomes a thing called knowledge. Now, how is knowledge different from just the information? Well, knowledge can, in itself, give answers to inquisitive thought or inquisitive thinking, allowing a creature, a person, whoever, to be able to see a future event and be able to make a prediction based upon its interactions with its environment. Information without knowledge eliminates the ability to predict and to be able to have, we'll say, informed, but more than informed, the ability to determine ahead of time one's interactions with some degree of accuracy. And so knowledge is very important because without it, we would have very inaccurate interactions with our environment, which could become fairly quickly dangerous and even fatal. So knowledge is important, but not all things that are alive develop much knowledge. Knowledge requires quite a few number of inputs of sense. There could be up to 7 inputs of information in 3 bodies. That's 21 different ways that a person could get information. And those 21 different ways can combine in 21 factorial ways, which is a huge number, by the way, to produce new kinds of knowledge from all the different ways we can join senses if you have up to the maximum number of senses such as a human being has at the life level that we live at. Now, there may be, as an example, some forms of life that have greater senses developed in other spheres beyond the 3-dimensional spheres I mentioned. And those spheres, because this is factorial, get huge numbers of greater amounts of information, huge numbers of greater amounts of knowledge. As a matter of fact, at a certain point, you become omniscient about the lower parts of time and space because you actually have the ability to have knowledge about everything that exists within those knowable possible ways that you could interact with the world or someone else could, making someone obviously greatly, improved upon in their ability to have accuracy. And accuracy, when it is applied for the sake of all, not just for the sake of the being or person who is seeking accuracy, becomes wisdom. That's a kind of interesting thing. So, but it has to be applied to everything that the knowledge contains within it and could be used for. So it's a fascinating thing. As we develop, therefore, this very huge, big concept itself, there's this beginning part where, again, moving through it quickly, we have input from senses. That could be something as small as a bacterium having some sense of whether or not there is a protein, a nucleotide, that it wants to bring in or expel from itself in a certain situation around where it exists. And this may even only be not even having to do with the more complex way of dealing with energy, such as photosynthesis. This may just be literally taking in and out chemicals, like certain hydrogen sulfide or something. And just being able to do that and sense that there's hydrogen sulfide out there, take some in, do some changes with certain other chemistry, carbon dioxide and other things, and you end up with a thing called ATP and some sugar and sugar and eventually energy. You end up with energy. And the amazing thing about this is that this form of life is possibly only using a couple of senses, literally. Wow. And only in the realm of the physical, I shouldn't say only, but mostly in the realm of the physical and electromagnetic part of the physical or etheric part of this world that we exist in. Outside of that, it could have some meager, maybe a single sense developing of an astral nature, which means it has a feeling besides a sense of what we would call the touch of physicalness. So it has some feelings in itself that it develops as well from a partially made astral sense. It has probably no mental sense at all. But it's an amazing thing that here is a life form. Primitive existed maybe 3 billion plus years ago, and in an archaic way is able to exchange chemicals from itself and its surrounding. It may live in a highly energetic environment where it's pretty hot or pretty because that makes it easier for it to exchange energies. And it does so without using external oxidation because the environment it lived in didn't have much available free oxygen. So it has a unique kind of biochemistry that allows it to exist in the most rudimentary environment, and yet it is already getting information. The information is rudimentary at best. Now, there's a little quirky thing about this, and I guess this is where the coming in with God perspective is. There isn't just this isolated bacteria that's running around, or bacterium, all over the place that are disconnected from something of a higher nature. Quite the opposite, there is a soul that, in a group fashion, may be the soul for billions of these, or trillions, even possibly, of these bacteria that have a source of greater consciousness, meaning greater understanding, about what the perspective of God is. The soul is like an intermediary. God's not going to concern itself with the bacteria on Earth because the souls of Earth that do this sort of thing do a fine job. And they don't have to have micromanagement. Even the group soul isn't micromanaging. It's giving each bacteria a little bit of a connection to very great understanding that the soul has, just a little bit so that the bacteria is egged on, so to speak, to want to continue to live and want to eventually create more of itself and want to be something more than it is. This comes from a higher level of consciousness than exists in the life itself. And behind all evolution, it is the quagmire that evolutionists have as a problem. Because when you get right down to it, just as there's this problem about what came before God, what came before evolution? Because in many respects, and what comes after evolution, how does evolution sustain itself when the requirement for life is to continue to grow and to produce more of itself? The requirement for there to be the existence of life. And you have to ask yourself, well, why is that a prerequisite requirement? Why don't things just spontaneously become and then die? If that's how evolution really works. And why would there be this need to have so much more of itself? Well, the self that we're talking about is coming from the soul. And that's coming in an indirect way through God's perspective in God. So ultimately, everything is borrowing a little piece of its creator to give it a leg up on self-creation. Is it possible? Is it possible for something to create itself through non-self-development and to eventually end up with a self? And the answer to this question appears to be no. And you might say, well, that sounds odd. Why could it happen? I can even think of it. You know, a bunch of chemicals come together, and suddenly, bingo, bango, they get a sense, and their senses produce the information necessary for it to develop some level of knowledge, and eventually that knowledge then has understanding. Here's where the glitch comes in. For it to get to that far, it already has to have done a lot of, we'll say, renditions of creating new of itself over and over again, because the bacteria only live for a very short time, and there isn't anywhere near that time for the bacteria to gain the information necessary or do any of the other things that would be required to get to the point where self could be developed. Time is the problem. And unless you can sort of, like in a hard drive or maybe a solid state drive or whatever kind of drive you want, unless you could store all this for each generation going forward, it just doesn't work. As a matter of fact, mathematically, it doesn't work. Francis Crick, one of the people who discovered DNA, got a Nobel. He and another person got a Nobel Prize. But the point is that his viewpoint is that it would take 10 times, maybe more than that, to bridge that gap I just described, to allow there to be any kind of life developed. 10 times the time that it seems to have taken on Earth. And so you get into this kind of question, and okay, that's the mathematics, and that's using the best possible, you know, a lot of fudging on the numbers to try to get it as close as quick as done. But probably it's way longer than that. So we have a basic problem. It seems as though for something to have developed its own self without any help from, quote-unquote, a greater being, that being has to have what is known as control over half of the entire field of possibilities that exist within the realm of that particular self's life. Now, this isn't hard to have, by the way, if you have godlike beings, if they could control huge amounts, way more than half in some circumstances, of a particular environment in terms of understanding, and so they can create themselves. It's not only possible, it's likely. But the problem is when you get down to the smaller parts of life, the parts that are pre-life to life, you're going from chemicals into living things, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Then the other thing is, the life has to be prophetic. It has to, the supposed self that's being created by this life form, not only has to have awareness of who it is or what it has to know what it's going to become 100 million years ahead of time. Because it has to develop itself into that other thing that's going to happen as it and its other creatures change the planet to some extent and other changes take place separate from it to the world, making it from a non-oxygenated atmosphere into a fully oxygenated, highly oxygenated atmosphere, and in which the exchange of chemicals changes for a much more efficient process called photosynthesis. Still being done in bacteria in the beginning, they eventually develop into plants, but still, it's got to know all this beforehand. It's got to have knowledge that predicts the future to 100 million years ahead. Remember, knowledge is the ability to predict? Well, that kind of knowledge, I don't think any bacteria have. You see what I'm saying? So who has it? Well, souls have it in part, and certainly God has it. But so we start seeing that there's a tremendous up and down relationship. Life at the lower levels is being bootstrapped up, not by itself, but by the high, very high levels of knowledge and consciousness beings, especially at the very top of it, God itself. So there wouldn't be a universe if there wasn't a God, because at the low end, life is incapable of developing itself in a way in which it's survivable, using just evolutionary model. That doesn't mean evolution doesn't exist. It just means it doesn't exist for the purpose of creating what we would call eventually consciousness. And it's why so many dear people I know, friends and associates, who are very strongly evolutionists, have a lot of trouble with even what is consciousness. Because it's, if you really believe in evolution, consciousness becomes unknowing, unknowable. Wow. This is the basis of what tonight's show is about, but it's also the basis of what the perplexing issues are in modern times between people who don't have a belief, we'll call it, or even an understanding or anything about God or a creator, and those who do. Because those who do may not understand the things I just said, but just the fact that they say, yeah, I have faith, I believe in God, because all that around me tells you that, even though I haven't figured it out in some concept level. And the interesting thing about this is that those folks seem to be in conflict with those who don't. And the reason for it is that without God, one comes up with many false conclusions. But with God, if it's only faith-based, the conclusions one comes up with may be not equally false, but certainly false in some sense, some ways. So you need to have still greater knowledge and consciousness or understanding to have a, we'll say, a more full understanding of God and God's perspective, which hopefully tonight we can come to. All right, so hopefully this is starting to make a little more sense. That doesn't mean it will completely for some people. Now, here's where we need to move on to. Okay, we've got senses. We've got different forms of life being able to sense in different amounts in each dimension of time and space they exist in, and many don't exist in the three dimensions of time and space that human beings do. Most, actually, the vast majority, exist in the physical and etheric or electromagnetic parts of our world, and they exist a little bit in the astral world. The more advanced forms of life that are not part of human exist much more substantially in the astral world besides the physical and etheric when they're physically alive, and they also exist to some much smaller amount in the monastic world or mental world. Now, what is that? What does that mean? It means they have much less developed mental sense, so they get less mental information. The information they do get mentally is much less brought together as knowledge or the ability to predict accurately what's going to happen when you take some action or interaction with them. And so all that is much less. And now I'm going to bring in something else. Their ability to create what is known as a concept, I'll explain that in a second, a concept is tremendously reduced from that of a human being. Doesn't it kind of make sense? That's the way it works. Okay, so that being the case, and understanding that that's what is happening, then what is the bottom line in terms of this lack of mental stuff going on, which we call thought, if you don't have concepts? Well, first, let's define more readily what a concept is. A concept is a formula of a way of predicting how things are going to happen. So you don't have to figure out for every set of examples, or every example of any particular interaction you're going to have, all over again, what the outcome is going to be. Instead, you have a formula. What is a formula? It's sort of mathematical, and it tells you that in these set of circumstances, the outcome of your prediction is going to be always this way. And the concept applies as long as a set of examples for it are applicable. And concepts are only good enough to meet the number of examples they can enclose. So you could have a very big concept that fits for most examples, a very small concept that fits for very few. And then you can have false concepts that fits for none. It doesn't work. But people like to think it is, think it does. And so that's called a false concept. And concepts as formulas save us time in thinking and a lot of time, which we call wasted or separated from space. So they're great time savers. And they are critical in allowing a life form that has significant amounts, large amounts of information coming in, to do something with that information to make knowledge fairly quickly. And so the concept allows us to much more rapidly, while human beings and some higher life forms below human, to build a predictive way of, we'll say, determining the outcome of various actions and interactions. And it does so with a good deal of accuracy, provided it fits the examples that it can fit. And knowing what fits is a unique kind of thinking, actually. And it allows, through a process called discernment and discrimination, it allows that which is thinking to actually challenge a concept to see if it applies in a particular situation or not, and then to know, well, how many does it apply to? Well, only to the level that we have experience, although using mathematics, it can be applied to many other elements, other parts of the mental world, but no concept is forever true, because you can have a concept, but all the examples to that point have proven the concept to be right until one pops in that doesn't. And when that happens, then a bigger concept exists, greater than the concept that is being used at the time. Wow, this is very interesting. So concepts that work for all the examples that we experience, we call truth. Human truth. Truth changes depending upon whether all the examples for the concept fit and there isn't some contradiction and shows the concept not working. The formula isn't working for it anymore. And that happens all the time. All the time. So truth is relative to the amount of information that has been garnered, the amount of knowledge that has been built up, and how much that knowledge, as examples of it, do not contradict a particular formula. If the formula works, then we know, whoop, there we go, we got truth. But the truth may change. If more information comes in, a lot more, and we get different knowledge, more knowledge, and a new concept may be built that's larger than the one that was used before. Also, false concepts will be driven out by the system, because a being with mental senses knows when the mental sense isn't working properly. It creates a distortion or a problem in the ability to use the mental sense, and we have a sense of that. So we say, that isn't working. That doesn't work. We don't recognize our mental senses as much as we do our physical or astral, and so it's a little hard to recognize what I'm even talking about. But most people, they really, really think a lot, know they only have that. All right, so looking at the process from the perspective, again, of God. In God's perspective, the development of concepts in a monastic or mental body is critical to eventually reaching a kind of a, quote, human level. Now, what is this human level? The human level is that the number of concepts is sufficient, right, to define and or explain the level of interactions that the person chooses to take or have, or that are thrust upon it. So all the levels of interactions that a particular life form may choose to have, or would seek to have, or just would have because of circumstances or otherwise, become human when all of those interactions can be covered by or created by a concept or formula for modeling or choosing examples. And so we call this, the concepts are called concepts, the model of the concept, sometimes we call forms of thought or thought forms, they're just examples. And if all the examples that you're using to create changes in your interactions around you turn out to be adequate for your creations, you have reached the human level. Wow. That's an interesting thought. So human beings, you could define humanity in terms of the ability to create formulas for the examples in their world that they are constantly adding to or changing, etc. Now, why can't your dog do this? Why can't the apes, supposedly very smart in terms of animals, do this? What's missing for them to be able to achieve this? Well, the first thing is they're missing two important senses, no matter how great of an animal they are, from each of the three-dimensional bodies that I mentioned, the physical, the astral, and the mental. And by missing those senses, they don't have the necessary ingredients to be able to, at will, create concepts necessary to challenge their environment and create new things around them, and to interact with, we'll say, hostile or adaptive necessities in life. So if you change the environment, they're in big trouble because they don't have a lot of readily accessible new ways to deal with it. Their adaptivity is reduced tremendously by these two senses. But what are the two senses? Because they seem to have the five we're familiar with, you know, well, in each of those three bodies, so 15 senses, that seems like a lot. What are the two that are missing? Well, they're missing consciousness, or we'll say awareness and then consciousness of self or God. Now, they don't have any understanding of self, and they don't have an understanding of how to create more of it at will. Self or God could be interchanged here. So I'm trying to bring together the God perspective. And they're missing that because it's such a big thing to have those two senses. If you have the two, which is really six because it's two in three different bodies, you've got a being who understands to some extent its own creator and seeks to create more of that creator in its surroundings. Now, what about the people who are atheists? Are they like animals then? No. Don't get me wrong about this issue. It just means the following, that some people have enough of this sense in themselves to balance out the equation necessary for conceptual framework of the world about them, and that is sufficient. If it's good enough to do so for those folks, they still have the sense of God, but they use it in ways that they choose to deny God. It's entirely acceptable to God to have this. You shouldn't realize that this is not, it may be the foundation of how evil does develop, but it is not evil. It's just a matter of how one chooses to understand oneself and therefore God. And by denial of the specialness of oneself, when you go through this process, you deny God too. And the results are that you can try to define the world around you through strictly non-creator concepts. And it's possible to live your life that way, provided you don't have any real, we'll say, big experiences that cause a sudden need to adapt. If you have a crisis that is extremely overwhelming, those folks who claim to be atheists will not be. So it's kind of an interesting thought. And I'll tell you more about that when we come back, because we're going to go to break here. And it is something to consider. The last thing I just said, I'm going to leave it with that thought-provoking idea. And we will get back into it in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we're dealing with the self-development coming from a perspective of God. And it's going to be, I hope, a more comprehensive show about this subject. So, let's continue on. We stop with the folks who say, hey, I understand enough of my world to be just fine. I like it this way. And I'm not creating a great deal more than what I already know, okay? I may get more knowledge by reading things, but I do choose not to create very much with them. And so, consequently, I don't need to worry about using these two God senses to actually have an understanding of God. I just use them to check out the concepts I have about the knowledge that I have that explains the universe at the level that I'm comfortable with, which is okay, because God knows that that is going to change. You see, the whole universe is set up to challenge that concept, to challenge it. You might say, whoa, to challenge that concept. Yeah, God, in its wisdom, said, hey, I'm going to throw a lot of curves at you. Adaptability is going to be required down the line. For human beings, it's going to be pretty severe at times because humans themselves cause crises for themselves as well as other things outside of themselves. So ultimately, we're going to have problems. And the problems, as they arise, will challenge the model that I have a good understanding of through my knowledge of how everything is, and I don't need God. And then when, you know, suddenly the hurricane comes, or there's a nuclear blast, or a bunch of real evil dudes take all your liberties away and enslave you, you say, wait a second. How am I going to deal with this? I'm going to have to be much more creative. And that's not comfortable for me because I don't have readily accessible answers to predicting what's going to happen in the future, so I become very fearful and anxiety-ridden and don't know what to do. And even when I do, I make too many errors because I haven't been using this part of myself very much. I didn't need it. Uh-huh. And I've been too egotistical, too arrogant even, because I thought I knew it all, and suddenly I find I know nothing. Also, there's the crisis of death itself. Those people who don't believe in God believe at the end of life, you're dead. That's it. Lights out. So long. Goodbye. That produces a very high level of fear, which gets repressed during the life process of these folks, and that leads to high anxiety states. So the bottom line comes out to be, wow, as you approach death, it's very hard to maintain this particular atheistic model because it's another serious crisis, and the only adaptation that a person can make is to succumb to the ultimate fear of it and ultimate anxiety of it, which in itself is brutally crushing. And no matter how hard they repress it, it is unnerving at best and torturous at unbelievable levels at worst. So it is a big problem, and we're all being set up for it if we don't change from that perspective. But we're allowed, because of free choice, to reject the whole thing and say, it's not such thing as a creator. And you tailor your viewpoints to this narrow vision. That's why egotism becomes such a natural tendency. Also, these folks want to control other people more because they feel so much out of control of their own life. And because they think they are entitled to do that, because they think they're really more knowledgeable than others when they actually are incredibly unwise and have a lack of truthful thought and a lack of understanding in their life. So looking at how this comes together now, where is the self in all this stuff? The self is the ability for a life form to determine what it is in contradiction and in, we'll say, somewhat difference to those things that exist around it. The more it understands what it is and what it is not, the greater its level of consciousness, and the more it can take this understanding to take the things that it is not and make itself in some way adapted to it, connected to it, or help other things to create more of themselves, all those things, the greater its level of consciousness becomes. Those things that choose to not do creative adaptation, those people, especially, who choose to narrow themselves with some kind of, we'll call it, mostly misguided and sometimes unfortunately wrong kinds of knowledge, result in a lower consciousness. They could be extremely knowledgeable, and they can have a personal kind of consciousness in which the information they have about the world is used at a very succinctly correct level. In other words, they really are good at living within a non-adaptable world where things don't get too upset for them. And they love that kind of world. They love that kind of government. They love that kind of everything. Everything is told. They're told what to do, and they tell everybody else what to do. And there's no room for creativity because anything that creates something could create something that is difficult to understand and difficult to adapt to and difficult to be creative about. So those issues then become the crux of the problem. And the self is the part of us that is able to be conscious of these anomalies and benefits and wonders of living. We can revel in it. Animals have a very limited self, that does not give them the God part of self, so they can adapt very minimally. Most of the self that comes into most animals comes from their group soul. The group soul has a much larger self, and it figures out ways to tell animals how to react in many circumstances. But again, that self is not very adaptable. It's a little bit adaptable, because the self of a soul is a little bit developed, of a group soul. But humans have individual souls. So they don't listen and respond through instincts to their soul. They listen to their soul only about things that are for the two senses in each of the three bodies that are about God. That's the only connection they have with their soul. They don't have a connection with their soul unless they choose to try to develop it with the other five senses in either of the three bodies. Oh, so our soul tells us more about God when we use our senses for that purpose. And when we don't use our senses for that purpose, our soul is mostly disconnected from us because we choose for that to happen, and our self doesn't grow nearly as fast, and we're less adaptable, and we have much more tendency to be egotistical, even possibly arrogant. We have a tendency to approach life from a non-God soul perspective. You see? Now, these are choices. Humans are making these choices from early on in their life. And in each lifetime, the soul tries to produce certain conflicts to get a person to leave their prior conceptions that are wrong about this from a prior lifetime. And at the same time, we're trying to build the senses up that give us better perspective, give us a better God perspective and soul perspective, and give us a better connection with our soul. And each time, it's a very creatively done exercise, but as a soul, we do it. We go back with our consciousness joining with our soul. We reconstruct a new lifetime, or construct a new lifetime, but it's using old parts so that we can fix our level of consciousness to some higher point by there being better connection with our soul while we're physically and astrally and more mentally alive. And while also we have the most opportunity to co-create with more of our Creator, while we're here, which is a fantastic way of living, but and one that is allowed for all human beings, but not necessarily pursued by that many on this in this world at this time. So it's a fascinating thing because the self of a human being is creating or destroying itself. Wow. And there's a part of the human being, the subconscious, which is not the self. Sometimes in the language I refer to it is the personality. Some people refer to it with different names. You may be, remember Freud, he would have referred to it as the id, I-D. But in whatever name you want to call it, the personality is only develops the consciousness of about a 10-year-old. That's it. Maximum level of consciousness, 10. Average level may be below that. Well, then you say, well, what? Obviously people get beyond 10 years old, right? That's because they develop their self in conjunction with the personality as much as the personality doesn't over-control the self. The personality tends to over-control the self, not surprisingly, when it doesn't have very much contact with its soul. The greater the contact with the soul, and in our languages, it might be the more spiritual, therefore, a person is. I'm not talking about religion now, but it could be some religions, it could be non-religious, but spiritual deals with God's existence and God's thought. The more someone has of that nature, growing up especially, the closer they are with their soul, and the greater the development of their self, the less over-controlling the personality is about that issue, And the more the person, by our standards, is an adult or matures earlier and earlier and keeps growing in that way. In some ways, people who don't have that happen remain childlike. Not because on a, you know, in a personal level they look like a child, but childlike in that they don't have the adaptability to be able to deal with all of the things that human beings were made to be able to deal with, including their own death. Because humans are aware through their two higher senses, of God's senses, of their own death and what that may mean. Animals are not. The lack of awareness of that is a critical change between animals and people. Are animals afraid of death? They're afraid of something harming them and ending their life. But they don't have the concept of loss of self, because they don't usually have enough self. There are some animals that gain some sense of self because we call them pets or we're very close with them, and they actually get it from us. But other than those, there virtually are none. Maybe there's a few that develop it on their own. Because everything's possible within this great universe of ours if you include the concept of self-development. So you could have a really unique animal that could do that. I don't know that you could have a unique plant to do that, but you know, that's a whole other story. All right, so we have self. Self is the part of us that is able to determine who and what it is in relationship to who and what everything else is. And it seeks to develop more of that ability. And if it does so wanting to emulate or co-create with its creator, which includes creating things that are beautiful, creating things that are joyful, creating things that help serve other people who have selves and everything else that's alive, reveling in what is it means to have God's perspective. Those folks that do that are, they have enormous capacity to grow selves. Wow. So it really has some amazing sides to it to talk about what a self is. Give you some basic thing like this to look at. Let's take an animal of, a mammal of reasonable level of consciousness for the animal. If it looks in the mirror, it will see in the mirror most likely an animal like itself, but it doesn't recognize that necessarily that the animal in the mirror is itself. And its reaction may be obtuse to looking at an image of itself. Maybe may react to the mirror as, oh, it's another animal. Or it becomes confused, doesn't know what is in the mirror. But regardless, if the animal starts reacting to the mirror as though it's an image of itself, that's a sign that it has some level of self-development similar to what we would call human. Most of the time, those animals have contact with people and are pets that are close to us. Not everyone's pet can do this, but the ones that do have developed some level of self. Isn't that interesting? And you have to observe the animal carefully to know whether or not it's able to do this. In Life's Meaning, the textbook I wrote, that is a picture in the book and explains more about it. But I think the idea here is that self can be more defined than most people think possible. So in other words, I've given a lot of different ways to define what a self is, and it is, it's not something that's imperceivable or it's nebulous or maybe it doesn't exist. It's really, really important to understand that it does exist. Now, let's talk about self in relationship to mind. At the beginning of the show, I talked about the mind. How is the mind different from the self? Well, the mind has to do with a piece of the self, a part of the self functioning within a dimension of time and space. We actually, humans, have a minimum of three, some people call it four, different minds. What are they? Well, we have an etheric physical mind. That mind is able to take knowledge and bring the knowledge together so that it has the ability to both predict what interactions it's going to take in a physical sense, in an etheric, electromagnetic, and physical sense, but also to determine the difference between what it is and what everything else is around it, the differences and the inclusivenesses of those things, discernment, discrimination, and to do so at the level that it is seeking to make changes to its interactions. It can reach that level, and therefore it has consciousness and it has a etheric physical self. But that's just the etheric physical part. Simultaneously, at the same time, there's a part of us that has a mind astrally. Oh, you didn't know that. We have a mind astrally. And the astral part is able to take the astral senses of feeling and to connect those in information to bring new feeling of knowledge, or knowledge of feeling, I should say, to knowledge of feeling. And then to apply that knowledge of feeling to be able to determine, well, first of all, to be able to predict accurately what kind of interactions are going to result in what outcomes, and at the same time, to be able to determine while we're doing those things, who and what we are in relationship to who and what everything else is around us. That's the astral self. The astral self does this in terms of how it feels in relationship to how all other things feel. Not how interactions on a physical level are going to take place, but how feeling levels of things are going to take place between us and things around us. That's the astral self. Got that? Okay, now this is the tricky part. There's the lower mental self and the higher mental self. You could call the two of them like almost like the physical part, which is etheric and physical. But this has its own definition. And we'll take the lower mental part first. The lower mental part takes examples of concepts, or we call them thought forms, puts them together. And each example of a concept put together and resultant in new information, new kinds of information that we call knowledge, but knowledge of experiences, knowledge of examples of things. We use those examples to then determine how the examples are different from how other people think and how other things think. Could be an animal, too. So how other people and anything it thinks is different from the way we think and how it's similar to the way we think. That's called lower mental mind and lower mental consciousness. Wow. Lower mental mind, lower mental consciousness. But we join those together most of the time, humans do, to some level, and create formulas for certain categories of examples so that it makes it much more easy for us and more quickly that we can think very much more rapidly. And because the concept joins together time and space so much better than the individual example does. And it really makes life more like creative for a human being. And so now we have a higher mental mind that works in concepts, but it still thinks and it can express itself in thought forms. Communication of concepts still goes through thought forms, just like I'm talking right now. So you have to build the concept from the thought forms. It's not so easy to do, so sometimes we don't communicate that well together. And the process, again, applies to see whether or not we have similar or dissimilar concepts of others, and whether our concepts are the same, and if they're not, then how others either are better or not so good. And it really helps us eventually to lead to the concept itself of truth. And there's a higher mental mind that's doing this and a higher mental self that's doing this. The lower mental mind is more subconscious and therefore governed by the control of the personality. So people who think only in thought forms become very personality-driven and subconscious to their world, whereas people who think in concepts more than they into mental thought forms have a higher form of mental consciousness, and that higher form allows them to use their self a great deal more. And if it's connected to their soul, remember we talked about this a little bit before, the connecting to the soul allows the self to become like the soul rather than like the person, a personality, and it frees itself from the control of the personality because fear is no longer holding it, especially fear of death, and it suddenly is a higher self. It takes on the self of the soul itself, and a higher self pays little or no attention, actually a pure higher self pays no attention, to its personal creations. It seeks to create for others and to help others to become more creative and to do so in a way that is part of its own creator or for God. It is God's perspective. It adopts God's perspective and the soul's. And the result is the higher self joins with the lower self. So you really don't see the difference. It's just one self, a huge, big self, that is completely adaptable, able to live life with virtually no fear. And to it frees itself to become as great as it chooses to be. And so its level of adaptation to its world is virtually infinite. It can create as much and as long as it seeks to. And it's based upon its own choices, not upon limitations of choice, as a lower self and a personality are so often driven by. All right. So consciousness is the ability, again, to create through connections, new connections, using bits and pieces of knowledge, yes, but beyond knowledge, it is the connections of how you make the knowledge that makes new things, that changes the ability to deal with crises and problems and the fear of death, changes the ability to balance the senses instead of relying mostly on the five senses without the two creative senses of God. And those two senses, for those of you who would like to know, are connected to the consciousness element of the heart and crown chakra. We all have heart and crown chakras, but we don't have consciousness in them. And having consciousness in them, which is the ability to understand the nature of the sense itself, if we don't have that, then we don't have the godlike ability that comes with it, and we're limited to what I said earlier about those folks who choose to go down that path. All right, so how does this leave us then, looking at the development of the self? Well, the self is the most important part of the physical, astral, and lower mental part of a human. Because it's through the self that eventually we become our higher self, which is really the higher mental part of our soul, and we can become connected to the soul in a, called, semi-permanent way, in which life here becomes the life of that soul here. It's like transferring the consciousness of the soul into us here through our willingness to use all of our senses in a balanced way. It isn't just amount of sense. Do not think that's true. You could have huge amounts of the two senses in the heart and crown chakra, but if you don't match that to the sense in the five lower chakras, you may become a saint or some other type of unusual person, or you may become highly religious, but not necessarily the most creative or virtue person. So the results are all kinds of strange combinations can happen if you don't balance these. If you balance them and keep them balanced as you grow them, requiring something called spiritual discipline to achieve, oh my, then no matter what level you're at in total development, the balancing of them causes a thing called beauty and an amazing improvement in the creative and adaptable aspects of being human. And it allows the self to join with the higher self in each creative, conscious activity. Every time you do something, if you're balanced in this equation with all the centers working together, you create more of the higher self, greater connection with God, greater connection with the soul, and it becomes, each connection is permanent. Each connection grows more and more and is permanent. Now, what happens if you do this, as people most of the time do, unfortunately, and you do it in an imbalanced way? The problem with that is that it isn't necessarily permanent. Consciousness is really never lost, but until it's balanced between all the centers and used for interactive purposes, it's not consciousness, really. It's more sort of an iffy gray zone between knowledge and consciousness, incomplete in its development. That incompleteness leaves it open for erosion, even to do sometimes it rarely happens, but it does, people get so entangled into the imbalance and so conflicted by it that they actually become evil. Wow, that's strange. You would think evil is the lowest level of consciousness. It isn't. It's more often caused by some higher levels of consciousness, but imbalanced in some strange and sometimes very potentially destructive ways, and can lead to the path of darkness and evil. All right. So the self is a big deal. The self is what we relish. Why is the self self-created? Because it is free. It's free to do whatever it chooses, or it can't create itself any further. Once it's imprisoned by either its own choices or by, we'll say, the effects of tremendous outside pressures at making it very limited, then, if those things take place, either one, then the self becomes less and less as it interacts. Every interaction in slavery or reduction in freedom of a person in itself reduces further its consciousness and leads towards a eventual heading for darkness of the person and those that other people like it, and it's the road to darkness. And this, unfortunately, is known by the dark side. So it's like, hey, if we can just enslave everybody, it'll be perfect, because we get everybody to turn dark, because we reverse this whole process. How much do they understand about the God part? Just enough to be dangerous, is what they understand. And they don't understand everything I'm saying tonight, but they understand a lot. And they reverse most of it so that they don't have to really think about all the outcomes. They just have to reverse stuff. And they don't have to be super creative, because reversing creativity is easy. Absolutely destroying creativity requires great amounts of creativity, which is very destructive eventually to the person trying to do that. But it may take some time for it to completely work itself out. All right, so how is it that then God came up with this plan that life would be on a grand journey for developing self, becoming more and more conscious? And it would all start with just senses and all the stuff I described. How come the procedure is so intricate? What leads to this amazing array of intricacy of life? And the answer is a pretty clear one once it's explained, I think. And that is that in order to just get to the most rudimentary elements of self, a life form needs to develop huge amounts of information coming from as many senses as each life form can develop. And life forms gradually improve in the development of sense. They do so by commensurately developing slight amounts of consciousness, which is the beginnings of self. They don't reach the point where we say they have a self, because we compare it to ourselves, until they are almost human. But even plants and some forms of life that are between minerals and plants, or between plants and animals, even those life forms have a minuscule beginning self. Now, it's hard for us to identify that a plant has senses, much less self, although a lot of people will agree that some plants, obviously, if not all, have senses. But it's hard to see the self of a plant because its response to its adaptation, which triggers in us a sense of self, its response to that is so slow in most plants that we don't notice it. And even if we do notice it, because there are a few plants that demonstrate faster responses, but even if we do notice it, we think it's more of a chemistry than a level of consciousness. In other words, oh, well, it's just this molecule reacting with that one and causing this change in the stomata of this thing. But that's only the external signs that we choose to see rather than to recognize the consciousness elements. Such as, a lot of people are aware that plants will, obviously, over time, a lot of plants will move towards sunlight, will try to avoid various parts of an environment that will shade them from such light. They will move their roots towards water and other nutrients they need from the soil. We know that, right? They will use water to transpire and cool themselves, and to also release oxygen and take in some elements of carbon dioxide. And also, they have a number of other, responses to their environment, which we see as being plant-like, right? But consciousness, how does the plant respond in consciousness to the world around it? Well, there's been some experiments of music. Plants have at least one astral sense. By definition, you have to have at least one astral sense to have a plant. And they can have two or more physical, and they need one astral. But that's because there has to be movement between not only the astral senses, the physical senses, but there needs to be movement involved between the physical sense of reacting to the environment that I keep defining, But also, there needs to be an interaction internally of the plant in some feeling sense, feeling, about what that interaction means. Feeling. Plants have that. We don't notice it. How can we notice it? Some people use music. They play music to their plants, and they notice that when certain music is played to certain plants, they grow better. They may even survive an adaptation thing that would kill other plants. Well, is music the only thing? No. Music is not the only thing. Plants like the company of other plants, particularly of similar kind. There also seems to be some electromagnetic reaction or commonality to plants. And this is actually electrical or energy beings that exist. Some people call it divinic beings that interact between one plant and another, just like having a little radio signal between them, but it's a beam, it's the radio. And that's, now, can we prove that? Yeah, there's a way to prove that. Now, there's ways of blocking out these beings. Ugliness does it. And plants have a harder time living and growing in that environment. A lot of plants have to have comrades. Grass needs more grass. You take a couple blades of grass, it won't survive if it doesn't have more than that. Because it needs the commonality of connection, particularly in the astral sense it has, which is rather weak unless collectively used together. Wow. So all of this suggests much lower, but a form of consciousness. A structure to the consciousness as well. Also, plants get some consciousness from the group soul that they have. Now, the group soul just tells the plant, without it having to think, that when it's a seed, it's going to grow up, and maybe down too. And it's got to go through the soil to the surface and down the soil to the ground. This it does based upon information coming to it from its group, soul's self. Because it doesn't have a great enough self to know that at that point, to understand that it's growing in any particular direction for a reason. Very interesting. What happens if you take a plant outside of gravity? Does it know what way to grow? Yep, they did experiments. They do. Well, how does it know? What I just said, isn't it? Okay, so it's something to consider. By the way, the sense of gravity is almost non-existent even here on the surface of Earth once the plant is in the ground. If you are trapped in a snow avalanche or just buried in snow, do you know which way is up or down? Now, the sense of gravity is lost when you're buried. Okay, so because you're supported on all sides. Now, the interesting part about this is that there are so many examples, I'm just giving you a few, of these sorts of things. Why is it human beings don't even notice their own consciousness and that of a whole bunch of life around them? Because they don't balance their centers very well. And because they may be very weak in their sense in the two centers that give us the best understanding of self and of God. By missing that, by not growing it in ourselves, or by being out of balance, it leaves us blind, literally blind, to the truth. These days in psychology, and tonight's show is certainly about esoteric psychology, by the way, these days in psychology, the concepts I'm talking about are more absent than they were 40 years ago. How do I know that? Well, 40 years ago, I was just going into practice, and I was also running a mental health institute, and I was teaching and doing all kinds of things. The understanding of self was way better then than it is today. How come? Well, the answer is rather disappointing. It is that the majority, well, I don't know if it's a majority, but a large number of scientists, particularly scientists who are psychologists and or psychiatrists, are we'll say, lacking in consciousness about our Creator. They are, for the most part, atheists. And at best, they may be agnostic. And the issue, the problem with this is that that is the part of them that tells them about God and all that, and it's the part that makes them conscious enough to be able to recognize the self. If they aren't conscious enough to recognize their own self and that of those folks around them, of course, it falls out of the lexicon, it falls out of everything involved with psychology, because the psychologists themselves don't understand it. Therefore, even if it had been written, which it was, about decades ago, it's just ignored and lost as part of the working understanding of people today. I've seen results of this in just recent times. It's scary. We're going backwards. Consciousness can't be destroyed, but it can be ignored. And people can destroy their ability within their particular life form at the time of facilitating the use of consciousness. So while the consciousness a person has goes on to live as a soul, and that part is in itself immortal, for the person in the physical world, particularly the physical, they may actually lose consciousness. Consciousness can go down significantly, as it can elevate. There's two kinds of consciousness, as I said earlier. There's a more personally founded consciousness, which serves the lower self and serves the person mostly. And that's like being more conscious when you're in your profession, being more conscious in a lot of areas of life that people seem to think, in a more mundane sense, is important, such as earning money. But it doesn't get to the level where you're more conscious about your creative and more conscious about being creative and co-creative with your creator. Then that is a reduction in consciousness, even though the personal consciousness for a while will continue to grow. Some people have amazing levels, like a significantly high level of personal consciousness, but almost no higher consciousness. The part that joins with the higher self is mostly missing. Then that's a problem. That's a big problem. When one number is greater than the other, if the higher consciousness is lower than the lower consciousness, then people have very serious conflict. They're more likely to become possessed and even turn to the dark side of life. What happens if you keep the two about the same and you keep growing them? They start to cancel out their own growth. You grow in one way in one, and you lose in the other. Then as you grow in one way in the other, you lose in the other. And you keep going back and forth with the trade-out that is not that much growth over time. Not a good outcome. So what's the bottom line? What do you want to do? You want to focus on growing the higher consciousness the most. Is lower consciousness, therefore, do you just give it up? Like, oh, I'm going to go live in a cave. I won't worry about doing anything. No. You just shift the motive for what you're doing. I'll give you an example. Let's say, well, I could use my consciousness to become very wealthy and maybe even authoritative or whatever with other people. Well, that may not be the greatest thing if you do it because that's what you want to do for your lower self, right? But what if you want to use these abilities, same abilities, but you want to use them to help other people to be free and to choose and to create or co-create more of themselves or not to with God? Now, all the same, we'll say, development of consciousness, making more money, developing a great understanding about a lot of different things that other people find helpful, all of that, if it's used to help and serve all all of other life, and especially other people, because that's what we are as a person, the results are amazing. The higher consciousness grows with no conflict to the lower self, because the lower self becomes attached to a part of the higher self. And the reason there's no conflict with the personality in this situation is if you do everything I'm suggesting, the personality actually joins with the soul, not its higher self, but with the soul itself. Now, what does that mean? It means the personality gains its knowledge instead of from its senses into itself, into its not itself, not its lower self, but into it. It says here, soul, you have it first. It actually gives the information to the soul. Now, this is very threatening for it because it's giving up complete control. It says, oh, I'm not going to have to control anything. I trust my soul. And so it gives the senses that have been giving it information and it's been creating all this new knowledge to its soul. And the soul says, sure, I'll create new knowledge with you together. We can do this thing together. And so it's called fusing. The personality actually fuses with the soul. The two become indistinguishable. And it goes from being 10 years old to being the wisest of all beings. Like, and this could happen relatively quickly, a number of years, but not certainly decades. Yeah, it can. I'm not saying it's going to, but it can. So, wow, let's look at this from a practical standpoint. This is no, terrible journey of a person going through excruciating and mind-numbing and ridiculous levels of slow growth. The opposite. Someone moving in the direction I'm describing it is developing their self at a pace that is huge. Lifetimes of growth are possible in years of time, particularly here in the physical world. It's harder to do this once you go to the astral world because you have eliminated seven senses of information of any usefulness. You can't get it anymore because you don't have a body to use it. And that slows everything down because everything is factorial. It grows by the number of senses. You've cut it way down and your growth rate diminishes in terms of developing consciousness. Isn't that strange? Even though you become, from your native state, you actually develop a better balance in your centers, and so for most people, after they die physically in the astral world, they're a bit more conscious than they were while they were physically alive. However, the rate of growth in the astral world is not possible to match that in the physical, all things being equal. Don't even come close. So most of the potential for the higher end of things is lost. Yes, you pick up some consciousness, but at a tremendous cost of what the maximum amount of possible growth would be. It's very limited because you have seven senses out of the 21 possible. They're gone. There's a little bit of an exception to that. I'll throw it out for you. And that is that those people who have done a lot of the fusing process between the personality and the soul and have joined their higher or lower self, when they go to the astral world, they still have some of their physical sense joined with their astral sense. The senses actually fuse. They don't have any more physical energy because it just doesn't exist there, but they can recreate the sense of what it is in astral energy. Whew. That's a little hard to understand, but it's true. It's absolutely true. But only those people who have done this as, we'll call it a spiritually disciplined activity, for usually a long time, can achieve these kinds of results of any magnitude. We all do a little bit of it, no matter what, but it's not enough to make any significant difference. But if you really make it your life quest, this then becomes a huge, huge potential. And the same is true of the monastic senses. You can actually fuse each of the senses into the next body and beyond to create an almost seamless life. As you join those senses together that way, if you were to do it completely, you would become a member of the next kingdom. No longer human. That's the definition. The consciousness of a superhuman is someone who has joined all 21 of the senses, all 7 of the senses in each body into one, and all of those ones into one at one time. Wow. And the time and space to think is reduced. The ability to do predictive thought is huge. Consciousness grows enormously, make connections to everything imaginable. Creation is like beyond all imagination. And you're living as a soul. Members of the next kingdom are called liberated souls. They live as souls. They are souls. And they can live in any one of the 3 lower dimensions and part of the Buddhic dimension as they choose. Their senses work in all the dimensions at the same time, and their focus of consciousness can be equally the same in each one at the same time. They become omniscient. Okay, so this is a pretty remarkable thing, and it all comes from this concept tonight of developing the self and understanding what the self is doing for us and what we're doing with it. Remember, this is us creating us. It's not some other being saying, okay, you do this, you get 5 brownie points, and you are now. No, nothing like that. Nothing like that. I know some religions kind of point us more towards that, or some people want to believe that because it's easier, it's most responsible for who they are. Someone else that just rewards you every time you do a good thing. It's good karma. Actually, karma is us split in time. It's not really anything different than that. I won't get deeply into that, but it's not that someone or something else is doing it to you. It's that you're not completing what you're doing now until much later in your perspective of time. And that's what karma is. It is still you doing it to you. Now, if your lifetime's apart, you may have no recognition that that's a true statement. But those who have high consciousness can connect all the dots. And they say, oh, that was from 3 lifetimes. Oh, that was from right now. Or that will happen sometime in the future. This is the amazing perspective that those who develop the self can achieve. All right. Some people at this point might say, yeah, well, I love what you're saying, but, you know, I don't know. Myself is not like, you know, I don't think I can create any answer to anything, and adaptability may not be the greatest right now. I'm having a hard time even making ends meet and this and that, and I got this health problem or that issue or that kind of interpersonal problem in relationship with someone or something or some others, and these legal issues and that kind of bad thing happened to me. This goes on and on, right? Okay. How do we clarify, then, and solve those kinds of problems in self-creation? Self-creation, remember that. The first is overcoming fear. Most people are restricted by their personality due to 2 factors. The personality is excessively fearful. I mean, if you're 10 years old, and even if you're a normal 10-year-old, the world is a pretty fearful place to a 10-year-old. And the personality is, in addition, over-controlling. Because, by its nature, it was designed for the first 10 years of our life to make it so that we could survive, and in addition, give us at least a foundation. After all, we don't have instincts. We need some part of us that has, we'll say, a continuous message that it's putting out to ourselves, but also to that it's controlling from behind the scenes. That is that we've got to survive, and we've got to avoid pain, and we need to have more things that make us feel good so that we are not going to be miserable, because that seems to be destructive to life itself. In addition, it is going to attempt, as much as possible, to limit the need for us to adapt, because it appears adaptation as requiring a lot of creativity, which is prone to error, mistakes. Mistakes are painful. They produce loss of life, loss of control. And the personality says, I don't like any of that. I know what I'm here for. I'm here to stay alive, make sure that my being stays alive, and myself, my lower self, continues to exist too. Personality wants itself to exist because it's through itself that most of the enjoyment of life, or i.e. meaning in life, exists. A meaningless life is extremely torturous to the lower self, which causes the personality to become extremely agitated and more fearful and more desperate for something. Now, some personalities become very aberrant when life has a lack of meaning, because it is obviously causing it, but doesn't realize it. And so it will choose these aberrant behavior patterns, like stimulation and excitement, a seeking of substances to abuse, to reduce both anxiety levels, fears, and to give a sense of very, we'll say, temporary, pleasurable feeling. Excessive amounts of certain activities that seem pleasurable, at least on the surface, such as sexual experiences, or possibly some things that are de minimis in terms of their overall development of self, but they appear to be fun. It could be anything from some forms of play to certain, we'll say, enjoyable hobbies to that particular person, but things that have a narrow range of creation involved with them. That doesn't mean you can't have a hobby and be somewhat creative in the hobby, but most hobbies actually are non-creative for the most part. Isn't that interesting? Okay, so we have within it we can see that the structure of the nature of this situation is that the poor self, literally, is being bullied around by a personality that has all kinds of issues and problems, that there is a nature to existence in life, particularly the physical world, that humans are prone to be victimizing themselves in, where they reduce their level of self in order to become safer as far as the personality is concerned, and they further maintain a level of self which over time becomes more and more meaningless. Because the self only develops meaning as it creates more of itself. Meaning isn't a thing that a person does that it even achieves. Meaning is a continuous, expanding state of growth. Something is meaningful when that is taking place. You can only grow the lower self to a certain point, and this is absolute, by the way. You can only grow it to a certain point, and that point is the point where you can adapt to all of the issues, all of the issues of interaction that you've chosen to do for yourself. Once you reach that absolute level, you can't exceed it. And then meaning diminishes from that point forward for the self, the lower self. The only way out of that vicious problem is for the lower self to start creating itself into a co-creator with God and develop more of its higher self by serving other selves, etc. And that is the key to developing a greater and greater level of meaning in life. Let me give you an example, because that might have been hard to understand or follow. Let's say that you're going to become the world's greatest pianist in your mind. And you work at it very hard, and you continue to become greater and greater and greater at it. And you reach a point where you've reached the level where the amount that you could improve does not equal the amount of development of self. So you don't become any greater in yourself to improve any part of playing the piano. You are maybe the best in the world, but even beyond being best in the world, even if you're not the best in the world, you've gone as far as you can go to develop your lower self in that way. The more you attempt to perform that particular activity, the less meaning there is in it to you. Wow. So the lower self now diminishes in its meaning in life, which causes it to suffer, by the way, and the result is the personality says, oh, this isn't good, or no, I don't like it. It's not good. And how come it's this is happening? It's because it's doing it due to a overall selfish attitude. The self only gets out of this thing when it says, ah, I'm only playing for the benefit of others. Beyond that, I want others to learn how to play the piano themselves or do anything creative as my activity may encourage them to and help them to do so. Now you're doing everything for others and their selves. You're becoming more of a soul, and now that activity is endlessly meaningful. Endlessly meaningful. And that's now you're becoming a greater, higher self. And the lower self and the higher self are joining together. The personality says, maybe I can go along with this, and it starts to fuse with the soul. It allows the soul to take information and directly use the information without the personality having to dictate what part of the information becomes knowledge. It's the soul that will decide that. In for the benefit of others, not for the benefit of its lower self. That's a big change. That's a huge shift from where it began, its existence. And whether it can survive doing that, it's a huge question. But it's willing to go along with it because the meaninglessness in life is so torturous. It will try. Now, some personalities become kind of, we'll call it disordered. They reach this point that I'm talking about where they don't get enough meaning in life. And instead of moving on to create more for others, they decide to become destructive to others or become in some way manipulative and controlling of others because they can't bring themselves to the point where they're willing to live for others. That leads to serious conflicts. It leads to darkness. It moves people away from being with God. There are so many different ways it becomes disordered that I can't even describe them. There's just hundreds. But each of these general categories of ways has, as a foundation to it, this, we'll call it sour grapes attitude, coming from the personality and contaminating and lowering the value of the self. Every time the personality intervenes with allowing itself to just grow, become more of its higher self, it is diminishing itself. It's actually reducing its own self. So people with these disordered personalities are actually diminishing their self, which is the cause of the disordered personalities to begin with. And the personalities then grow in weird ways, sometimes obscene ways. They even seek to destroy the selves of others to make themselves feel better, because they, in relationship, compare their lower self to other people's lower selves and say, aha, if I could just get their lower selves to be less, then I'll feel like I'm more. Yeah, the extreme of this is like sociopathology, and worse than that, psychopathology. Instead of just diminishing the self of others, why not just kill them all together? I mean, so you end up with these kinds of crazy reactions to this, the nature of this relatively basic issue. Boy, how much there is to understand about all of our existences from this one idea of self. Last week, we talked about psychosis. It's a very limited issue in comparison to this week. This week, it's really about the bigger picture of self and how it is that we can do something to really make a difference if we can just learn this one area. I swear, in my mind, this is probably the most important lost area of understanding in the whole world. This is the single most important thing for people to gain. A lot of people say, well, couldn't you just believe in God? Wouldn't that work? Maybe for some folks. But we have grown to the point where a faith-based outlook has to be matched, remember, by enough knowledge that is applied so that in particular situations we can come up with a deterministic way of moving in our interactions. Faith-based doesn't do that. It does the reverse, actually. It abdicates that concept. It works for some people in some ways. And it is not necessarily wrong. It just isn't going to work for a lot of folks. And it doesn't move you into the true development of the higher self. For a lifetime, a person could be faith-based, and maybe it will work for them, depending upon how creative they want to be. If their level of creation is going to be relatively low, and if their ability to create isn't much higher, a faith-based position is actually practical and may work. For a lot of people, this is not the best position. Faith is okay to have in the highest realms of interaction with God, but when you try to apply it to the minutia of life, it becomes an obstacle to the greater, to the development of greater, higher levels of self. And it kind of turns the whole thing upside down. I'm going to give it all to God. It's not what God wants. But to a person who's doing that, they reverse most of the things they think God may want. It becomes a deterministic understanding. They'll say God gives us choices, but God chose everything already. So we can choose to live with God's choices or avoid God's choices. Too many contradictions in logic and other problems with that. But the bottom line is that it is not necessary to give up belief in God to move into this new kind, we'll call it, of co-creative element with God, where it is not that one doesn't believe in God, just the opposite. One so fervently understands and believes in God that the creation that is taking place is part of being a small fractional piece of our Creator. And the tremendous, tremendous meaning that comes from that, and the joy, and even if it's done consistently enough, bliss, that can relieve us of so much of the torturous ways in which, unfortunately, people lose meaning in life. Now, I want to take this a little bit further. I don't, and by the way, I do not ever want people to believe that I'm condemning anybody. Why I have a faith? They have a faith-based attitude, and Niles McFlower says that they're no good. Now, I don't believe that at all. If you pursue a faith-based life and you find that your life starts having less meaning, you need to take listen to what I'm saying. If your life is tremendously meaningful from that position, it may not matter to you. As a matter of fact, it may even be a challenge to that meaning in your life at this point. There's a number of lifetimes that people need to move in the direction of just that sort of existence. It isn't necessarily based upon how many lifetimes you've had, although it tends to fall in the middle range of number of lifetimes that people average. But it is almost entirely based upon the level of creativity the person is going to exercise in that particular lifetime, as determined somewhat by the soul beforehand. The soul can't make our choices, but it gives us certain karmas that we have to deal with through our senses, and it deals with certain interactions we're going to have with so many other incarnates from other souls. It knows about all of that ahead of time. And so it can determine where our best strength is in development. And sometimes it is literally part of its plan. Literally. Sometimes it's not part of the soul's plan, but the human can decide. Even go against its soul's plan and maybe even make a different kind of life than what the soul originally thought. This is so hard for so many people to understand. I hear people say, well, God has a plan. Yeah. God's plan is that humans learn how to create a plan. Well, now you've got the complete contradiction, right? Well, what does that mean? Go ponder on it. Ponder on that idea. Okay, so here planning is part of consciousness. We're supposed to develop as much consciousness as we can. And we can use it in some way interactively with good predictive success and help. The most important thing is to help others to do the same and serve them and co-serve together. All right. So if a person is beyond that, let's say beyond meaning no longer focused into a life of meaning that comes from purely faith-based life, then there is a whole number of different issues that become operational. And some of them are the following, as far as the self is concerned. In many ways, within a single lifetime, the lower self reaches a meaningless position in regards to some of its choices in creating itself in its life. It may also trigger rebellion from its personality at times, every time it runs into one of those meaningless points. So these are the operable concerns in terms of where a specific person is at and what's the best thing for them. It's a lot better for a person to be able to consciously know who and what they are and be, even if it's something not the best of what they would like, because at that level they have the most likely option to make changes that will constructively add to the betterment of of God and everyone. So if we're all here to improve the nature of existence in life, not just for ourselves, but for everything and everyone, then bringing all of the contentious issues of a person's life into as high a level of consciousness as possible. Consciousness means, again, the ability to connect, to use what we've got in both knowledge and sense and mind to bring something new into existence. Wow. And it's the direction of our consciousness, which can change from time to time, which really makes the coloring of how we do things a truly growth experience for our lower self and our higher self when it's choosing to connect with it. We have these great options. Taking them is a, we'll call it, a lesson in self actualization. How do you do this? Nuts and bolts. The first consideration is to take account of the areas in which there are failures. Failures in terms of the following, meaning in life. Failures in terms of any disorders in personality, including acting out behaviors against your own self and the self of others, and or just selfishness, plain and simple. Also, the attempt needs to be made to reformulate concepts that are constructed out of egotism, and especially arrogance. Arrogance is like egotism, but also a lack of love for others, thinking that the only thing that really matters is you. And your own thoughts are what really matters to you. That's egotism, but the only thing that matters totally to you is you. So you're arrogant, and it's a terrible condition. So you got to take note of those. Write them down. Write down all the areas or record them, however you type them out, whatever it can do for you to bring them into focus. Why do you want to see all these negative things about yourself and your personality? Because it's from that you will find the answers that will solve the problem. I know it's hard to believe that because we all prefer not to think about those things if we could. But it is necessary to do this. And the more obnoxious you've been, the more problematic you've been, the more important it is to do these things. So I know it's hard. Is it worthwhile to go to someone else to talk about it? Maybe. But, you know, even when we pay someone to do this for us, we tend to be untruthful. We tend to sugarcoat. We tend to leave out the things that trouble us the most about ourselves. So I'm not so sure that that's possible for a lot of people. Okay. What's the next accounting you need to do? So we look at all these negatives, and it's fine. We know that we have certain areas of a lack of meaning. Describe the lack of meaning as it is in regards to each level of interaction or action with your world. So you have what is called as an operational definition of what the meaning is and lack of. Got that. The next thing to do is to project, using some degree of contemplation, what would be the most joyful things that you could do that would require creation, no question about it, and would be of service to others in some respect, using your capabilities as they are or as you can improve them in the not-too-distant future. That's a caveat. It has to be that. Otherwise, you'll get into fantasies that you can, I'll just help everybody to be flying to Mars tomorrow. You know, we'll all jump in my fantasy Mars ship and take off. Yeah, well, that isn't going to work. because you don't have that. And you don't know how to create that. Okay. But those are the kinds of things that you need to do if you're going to be proactive in the development of self and to end the conflict of personality, either disorder or personality, let's say, problems. What else can you do? I suggest the following. Have a discussion with your higher self and your soul, which is kind of the same thing in sort, and allow your mind to be free to hear the response of each. Got to be careful you don't fall into what is known as imaginative fantasy about this. How do you know you're not in imaginative fantasy? Because the information you will get will be conceptual and will be, when tested, highly truthful and accurate. So if you receive a new concept and it puts together a whole bunch of stuff you didn't see before and you test it out and it turns out that concept is really working, you're on the right track. If you get imaginations that are fantasies again, those aren't going to work out. You try to use them as any kind of concept and they don't apply. You find many contradictions. An example, you say, well, this is but nonsense. I just imagine that whole thing. Okay, so that's how you do that. What is the best time and place to do that? The best time and place to do that is after you've done the first parts of what I just explained. Contrition builds the ability to hear the soul because it develops humility. The more humility you have, the greater the ability to communicate with your own soul and to adopt parts of your higher self as yourself, your lower self. And the more you'll encourage your personality to join with yourself. So you're really getting this kind of nuts and bolts process that I'm trying to give you by being humble. Humility means you assume you don't know. You assume you are ignorant of things. You assume that you're wrong when faced by other persons or people's ideas and thoughts. And you let them, maybe for a while at least, express their thoughts and behaviors, allowing them to find out that maybe what they're doing isn't correct. But if it is, that's fine. Then you've really learned something, right? You really understand something. And either way, it's like a win-win situation. Humility, when done with your own soul, is the higher form of humility. Now, why is it the higher form? Because there's a thing called the lower controls in esoteric elements of existence, hidden parts of reality. What does it mean, lower controls? It means that God leaves it to the choices of things much less than God to co-create and help create more of God. Not vice versa. So if and when a person chooses to say, okay, I'm going to be humble in this situation, I'm going to not take charge, so to speak, immediately of anything. I'm going to hear what my soul says, be willing to do that. I'm giving up the fact that I'm in control to allow myself to become more creative and my lower self to grow to become my higher self more. So it's sort of like the denial of the thing that you have the power over so that you become something greater. As long as you want to hold on to that controlling nature, you can't become the great thing that you really are. It isn't as though you're trying to become your soul. You were your soul. You chose to become something much less than your soul so that you can contribute in areas the soul can't exist in as a soul. You can only create yourself into a soul as you create the world around you, the physical world in this case, into a more virtuous place. And as it becomes more virtuous, you become more your soul. As it becomes more godlike, you become more like God. That's the co-creation element. That is the formula in concept that God has used to create the universe. The discovery of it only can come, you can hear it from me, but it doesn't mean anything. You've got to live it to understand and truly be it. So the intellectual understanding, in a mental sense, even the emotional excitement of it, doesn't bring its reality into fruition because you have to create with it and in full consciousness while you're doing so. Unlike other things that people do at earlier developmental times where they can be mostly subconscious or partially conscious, this requires full levels of consciousness. What does a full level of consciousness mean? It means what I defined as earlier. It has to completely match your ability to interact and act with your within your environment at your full level of sense and balancing the senses as well. Do all that, and you've got full consciousness. Full consciousness is an absolute maximum consciousness. Full consciousness is still relative to us. That's what it is. It's relative to us. But that relative state, once we get there, it's like the sweet spot. It's that magic zone that helps us to become our higher self and to develop the maximum level of self. The maximum level of consciousness for who we are and what we are at the time. The maximum amount of service. The maximum amount of God. For who we are and what we are and where we are at the time. Now, to me, this is the most exciting part, the most meaningful part, and most interesting part of both psychology and of ageless wisdom. It leads to a completely, we'll say, new level of consciousness, not just a higher consciousness, but a new kind of higher consciousness that we'll call, and I used the word earlier, self-actualized spirituality. It's not just self-actualized psychology, which unfortunately has within it much humanistic aspects, meaning that it's about just being a human being and helping others to be human. It goes well beyond that. Self-actualized spirituality is helping yourself to become more spirit, more godlike in your thinking, and more godlike in your interactions, and also simultaneously helping others to become more godlike in both their interactions and in their being a part of God's own existence, God's own world. You're entering into that realm. That's what spirit is. It's God's thought. You're entering right into it. It's the reason it's God's mind, it's God's thought, but you're also putting it into action, and that's the three parts together. So it's all coming together. Now, when I say the three parts, for those of you who may not have heard or read this before, it means that you're becoming the thought of God, and thought contains two different elements to it. The choices that are godly, along with the direction to those choices of connection, which equals the choices, so that it evenly grows and balanced ways life in a very meaningful way for not only yourself, but for all the others that you touch. And it helps them to do the same if they so choose to. That's the thought. That's spirit in existence. That's thought and spirit of spirit is the thought of God. But the last action, the last interactions, the last part of this is the interactions, excuse me. The last part of this is the interactions, and you have to take interaction. You have to do something. You can't just think the stuff. Why is that important? Because the God's mind involves, we live in an interactive universe. It involves the part of the universe we think of as both energy, and when it's not energy, it's purely intelligence that is interactive with something else. So it has a thing nature to it, doesn't it? Well, once you involve things, then those things have an impact on everything else. So you're becoming, by the very fabric of the universe, intertwined eventually over much development with everything in the universe. Eventually your experience will be, therefore, that your consciousness incorporates the interactions with all other things in the universe. Life, non-life, and life. Eventually it all becomes who and what you are. Yourself extends to this great nature of universality. So you develop like a universal self. Beyond even the soul nature of self, into realms that are sometimes referred to as monadic, oneness with all. This is the eventual outcome of development itself. Now, a lot of people say, but isn't it true if you're becoming one with everything else, aren't you losing yourself? No. It seems that way to those who haven't gone through the process or don't understand the nature of what I'm talking about. So let's break that down so we get to it. The self doesn't go away. It simply maintains its greater and greater who it and what it is while it becomes connected to and a part of all other selves, but it still remains individually in its own existence. Both are possible at the same time, even when it seems paradoxical to be true for those who do not comprehend that. But it is, and it is. So the nature of self never diminishes. It only grows, but it becomes something that is so beyond human that for human beings to truly understand it, it's iffy. Because we never experience it as a human being. So we have to just sort of believe or have some, we'll call it, understanding in an intellectual sense, but with no experience. Because to have the experience is to be outside the human kingdom. Now, I will tell you, you can have the experience as a human being, but the requirements are such that most people aren't at that stage at this point. Almost all people aren't. And the few people that are going to soon be outside the human kingdom. And I see who, I'm talking about hundreds, not billions. So it's a very small number of people that really are moving and actually having bits and pieces of this experience, but they are too minuscule a number for us to consider. And I say, when I say humans don't, I'm talking about as a rule and as a vast number, a very small number that might have some parts of this. Well, we're just, if you want to make sure that we're not excluding everybody, okay, well, we could say there's a few. And in some ways, they're both in and out of the human kingdom. We've had shows on this, so you may have remembered some of this. The part that I'm saying that is so critical here is that the development of self has a whole scenario of ways to go about it that actually work. Now, I mentioned meditation. Meditation has within it several different elements. And I said it in practical terms. But for a few, we'll say, lifetimes, meditation becomes a very critical part. It isn't the end of the lifetimes. It's more towards the end. That people need to spend more time than not meditating because it requires such a high level of focus to get through some of the resistances that they have overall to giving up a lower selfish position, oftentimes connected to over-controlling personality. The most critical times to meditate are the times when things are going rather well. Now, I know that sounds strange. Why is that? Well, because if things are going rather badly, we tend to meditate anyway, even if we don't call it that, because of our threat in adaptation and sometimes our willingness to break through our own defenses in the cases where the fear of death and the fear of everything falling in on us is great enough. But the real problem for most people is when things aren't going so badly. That's the time you want to meditate because it needs to come from an inner need to give to others so they can do the same. And you need to have this, like, you have to develop it during that period of time because it's so easy to ignore. It's so easy to ignore the need to meditate at those times when everything is okay, why worry? Be happy. Yeah. Happiness is transient, it'll come and go. What you want is meaning, and you want to be one with God and to co-serve and to create so that others can do the same, so that you really have the true sense of ultimate consciousness, of oneness, and it's all there. It's all there. Everybody says, well, all we need is love. Well, love is the word I just said. It's the universal love. You can use that word if you prefer. Love can be used to replace the word consciousness, provided it's the bigger picture love, not the little love. And then you still have this as part of the development itself. Well, let's go through a little bit of a summation. So what have we got through so far? Well, we found out that basically the self is a remarkable part, mostly of human beings. It's very limited on an individual level in anything less than human, and especially if that thing, that life, is not connected closely to a human being. There's lower levels of self, very small levels, that exist in even plants. However, most of the self actually comes from another part of the life form in those that have even some self, because it comes from their group soul. Humans have individual souls. We develop ourselves because we find that that's where the meaning for our existence is, and it is separate from our soul until we choose to join it with our soul to grow our lower self into a higher form of self that doesn't exist just for our own sake. We have amazing capabilities, therefore, in consciousness. We can eventually take the knowledge that we develop from our senses and information and reconnect that knowledge in so many different ways because we can see so many different ways and so many other ways that we are similar to other selves and other life. And through this we find God, if we choose to do it that way. And in finding God, we co-create with God because we want to see godly things around us. We want to see God in everything grow more abundantly. Beauty is part of it. Truth, love, and interactions that flow effortlessly from one life to another. All of this is part of God for us. And we can help to grow these parts by developing ourselves to higher and higher levels. Most people fall into crisis in self-development because they develop themselves to the highest level they're capable of at a certain level of, we'll call it self-development, compared to their capabilities. And they find that after that, it becomes meaningless or boring to them. They lose the ability to find that which is truly their nature or part of God, because they are no longer self-creating very quickly. They slow down, so they don't like to slow down. And then they may, in crisis, look for God in becoming more like it and helping others to become more like it, rather than just being more selfish. This is the basis of the development of self in a human. Humans are so unique because they are made to find God and made to be a part of God. And they're the first kind of life that does this. Not the last. They go on to become other things besides human. But they are the first, and we are remarkable for that. We are no more like orangutans or like chimpanzees than we are like anything, because they are missing this crucial element of self that is so much the perspective of God. They do not see that life is an act of constant creation and adaptation to new and better things, and to change that which is around us to become an expression of not only ourselves, but of God itself, the elements I just said a few minutes ago. All of those factors come into play to make us really the benefactor of the greatest gift that God can give to any kind of life less equal to or less than human. The greatest gift is the gift of self. And yet this amazing gift is overlooked by most psychologists and people who are sometimes philosophers and so many scientists these days. It's frightening. Because it's almost as though we are literally living in a closet, missing the very nature of who we are and who all of our fellow humans are, all because we are having trouble finding God within ourselves. This nature is left open to be changed, maybe by tonight's show. Hopefully by everything else I've said or written in this area. There is a whole chapter in Life's in Meaning, the textbook I wrote about it. But one of 12 chapters is just about this subject. But actually, tonight's show may be more practical for some people. The important thing to remember is that of all of the aspects, all of the things that I've talked about in Angel's Wisdom, for human beings, tonight's show should be the preeminent issue, because if we don't pay attention to this, the other things that I discuss are pretty much not going to be of much use to anybody. Now, I know some people say, well, I'm kind of bored by self and everything else. I just want to learn something about how the universe works. All that stuff will not be of any use. If you don't develop the self, if we all don't develop the self to a higher and higher level, reaching our level of ability to do something with it and create willingness to create new opportunities to make that happen, if we're not going to do that, there's not going to be much change, much improvement. And God is not going to grow here in this world as it needs to. And then that leaves an opening for the dark side and for maybe the destruction of a grand planet as Earth is at this time. I hope tonight's show has made some meaning in your life, and we are out of time. Until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is. Thank you.